Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one.
Are
you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. It's Peter Schiff again. After a one-week absence during my trip to the Emirates, I am back. It is Wednesday, June 10th. 2009. Welcome aboard another live episode of Wall Street Unspun Midweek Market Update. The number to call, toll-free, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597 with your questions and comments. Anyway, I've been pretty busy. I was on The Daily Show yesterday. Many of you probably might have seen that. If you haven't seen it, there's dozens of YouTube clips, although I've noticed I went up there. Apparently, Viacom had complained, and so many of the people who had posted YouTube clips of my Daily Show appearance, a lot of them have been taken down, but there's still plenty of them up there, so if you haven't seen it. And, in fact, I think The Daily Show is actually rerunning right now. Yesterday's show is also repeated three times today. I think the last time is 8 p.m. Eastern, which coincidentally is when I'm starting this broadcast. But anyway, it was an interesting appearance. I normally, when I go on television, there's no audience. You know, when I'm on CNBC or Fox or CNN, it's just me, the hosts, maybe another guest, and then the camera crew. Whereas with the Daily Show, there is a live studio audience, and so there are a number of people there. So it made it feel more like you're there entertaining, or because you actually have an audience that's applauding sometimes, and so it was fun. It was fun to do the show. Jon Stewart was very gracious to me both before the show and in comments at the end of the interview. I have no idea when I might be on the show again. I don't know how often they have guests back, but I'm sure at some point in the future I'll do it again, although I don't know that it'll be anytime soon. We'll see if that appearance ends up resulting in any other mainstream-type appearances. And I look at that more as a mainstream show because it's not really an investment show. Most of the television I do is narrowly focused to investments. Once in a while, I've done some things on CNN that seem a little bit into the political realm, but normally I'm talking about investments to an audience of potential investors or people who are tuning in to listen to those investments. Obviously, Comedy Central has got a very different demographic and a very different audience, and also a lot more people obviously watch that show, looking at the sales of books. Crash Proof is now number 23 on Amazon. Even Crash Proof, I was just looking at the top 11 investment books on Amazon, and five of the top 11 are me, because there's Crash Proof and the Crash Proof audio version, and then the little book and the little book audio version, and Crash Proof 2.0. So of the top 11 bestsellers, five of them. And that's all the result of this appearance on The Daily Show. I have no idea how long it will last. But anyway, getting to what's been going on in the markets, a lot has certainly happened in the last couple of weeks since I did the show. First of all, the dollar has continued to be weak. At one point, the dollar index traded below 79 in the 78 handles. Then we had a snapback rally in the dollar. The dollar index got back up to about 81.50. Yesterday it fell back below 80. Today it had a rally and it closed just slightly above 80. But the trend is clearly down in the dollar. The chart looks horrific for the dollar index. The chart of all the various currencies look very strong. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand left interest rates unchanged this evening at 2.5%, which is still pretty low. The New Zealand dollar is up a little over 1% so far this evening. It did get as high as almost 66 in the peak, and it pulled back, and now it's around 60, 64. But the trend there is strong in all those commodity currencies, the Norwegian krona, the Australian dollar, the chart for the British pound. I mean, not one of my favorite currencies. We have very little exposure to the UK among our accounts. But even the British pound is back around 163, 164. Now, that currency was down. The contract low for the British pound was 135. So we've even seen a very, very sharp rally in the British pound. In fact, my target for the British pound, again, I still think the British pound can get around to 195, $2 before the end of the year. Of course, when that happens, I expect other currencies to be a lot higher as well. You know, the real big story has been the bond market. I mean, the bond market has just precipitously fell. You know, I know this. You know, I finally closed today on that townhouse I bought for my mom down in, or for my mom to live in, down in Boca Raton, Florida. And, you know, there was a lot of paperwork to try to get this mortgage. Even though it was a conventional conforming loan, I was within the Fannie Mae limits. I mean, I borrowed, I think, $400,000 on this property, and I put a 20% down payment. And it took a long time, you know, for me to even get approved, you know, because my credit rating was, you know, below 700. It was, you know, 680, 690, mainly because I didn't owe any money. But I had to give all these documentations, all kinds of stuff, and the thing, and some of the process was really lengthy. And I wanted to lock in my rate for a long time, and I finally was able to lock it in about 2-3 weeks ago. And I think when I first started talking about doing it, I was going to get 4 5/8. And I wasn't able to do that. I got 4 7/8 is what I locked in on the 30-year, which is 4.875. I think as of today, just less than 3 weeks since I locked, maybe 2 weeks. The mortgages are now, I think, 5.7. I mean, they've surged. I mean, they're almost a full 100 basis points, a full percentage point higher than they were just 2 to 3 weeks ago. Now, I know this is throwing a huge monkey wrench into the refi activity. And if you look at the chart, though, the chart of the bonds looks horrific. I mean, the yield on the 10-year bond in December, right, when the Fed announced that it was going to buy bonds, the yield was 2%. It's now 4%, right? We closed at 3.94, right? Basically 4%. We've doubled the yield on the 10-year bond since December. And if you remember my commentary back then, I talked about a bell ringing. I said that was the biggest sell signal I'd ever seen for the bond market, that there couldn't have been a louder bell because the Fed was going to print money to buy all those bonds. And I said that's the worst thing for bonds because it's going to destroy the dollar, which is what bonds are denominated in. It's going to lead to massive inflation. And that's what the markets are telling us. And we've seen this huge drop. And it seems to me that the bond bubble has burst. And there's a lot of air in this bubble, and it's got a lot of deflating to do. And if you look at the yields right now, we're about 4.75 on the 30-year and just about 4% on the 10-year. I think we can hit 5.5%, you know, even on the 10-year before the end of the year. I mean, there's some resistance up there. And once we break through that, you know, there's no stopping it. I mean, even right now, 4% on a 10-year, 4.8%, whatever, on a 30-year, that's still not enough, not nearly enough, to reimburse lenders for the inflation that they're going to suffer. I mean, the rates are still very negative right now, despite the fact that they've gone up. And if you look at what's happened with the commodity markets, look at the price of oil. Oil is now above $71 a barrel. Remember, oil bottomed out around $35. We've now doubled. And as you recall, I've been very, very bullish on oil on this program for some time. I was predicting that oil prices would hit $70 a barrel by the summer. And we're here. And technically, if you want to start summer June 21st, we're not even in the summer yet. And we're already at $70 a barrel. I think that the coast seems to be clear for oil prices to hit $100 a barrel, maybe even before the end of the summer, but certainly before the end of the year. And, you know, the first time oil hit $70 a barrel was in 2006. When it hit it on the way up the first time, individuals that were buying gasoline still had jobs. They still had a lot of home equity, or at least they thought they did. They still had, you know, a lot of value in their IRAs and their 401ks. It's very different this time. It's very different to look at $100 a barrel oil when you're unemployed and when you no longer have any home equity. And you know, and the other thing that's happening now is interest rates are really starting to rise, and you know, as a lot of these mortgages are starting to reset now, a lot of the teaser rates on the ARMs, those that are going to start to come due, they're coming due into a rising interest rate environment. And the Fed is really in a bind because the world is on to our scam at this point. I mean, look at the news today from Russia and I think in the other country, was it Argentina or Brazil? They're going to be dumping some treasuries to buy some debt from the IMF. I don't know why they're so excited about the IMF debt, but the idea is that they want to diversify out of the dollar. I mean, I think they should be buying gold or other resources. They should be buying private debt, private viable companies, or you know, maybe they should be buying Japanese or euros or you know other currencies. I don't know what the attraction is of the IMF, but I know that it's the dollar. Excuse me, that's unattractive, and they're trying to get out of dollars. And so this is what we're seeing in the bond market, in the currency market. And I think these trends are very, very powerful. And I think they're going to gain a lot of momentum. And, you know, and as the trades gain momentum, they feed on themselves. And these are very, very powerful forces and very big moves that we're seeing. And so if you think that bonds have fallen and interest rates have risen a lot now, just wait. You know, if you think the dollar has fallen a lot, just wait till it's below 70 in the dollar index. I mean, right now we're still at about 80. I don't think it's going to be long before we're cracking through 70. And when we do that, and if we do that, you know, all the currencies are going to be at record highs. At least they're going to be above their highs from mid-2008, before the economic crisis really started to unfold. And then we're going to be confronted with the real serious problem, which is, in addition to the recession, which is only going to get worse, we're going to have to deal with high inflation and high interest rates. And you know, if the Fed is in this bind now, the government's whole plan for stabilizing the economy is low interest rates to prop up home prices and to revive the toxic assets and try to give them value. Well, that whole thing goes out the window. You know, right now they're making a big deal about the fact that 10 of the banks that got TARP money are returning it. Well, first of all, there's a lot of banks that aren't returning their money, like Citi and like Bank of America, that'll never be able to return it. But the banks that are returning it are going to need the money back. I mean, the main reason they can return it is because the government changed the accounting rules. And now that they can pretend that the toxic assets on their books are not toxic, they don't need the capital. But what's going to force this realization is as interest rates rise and more people lose their jobs and default on their mortgages, you know, they're not going to be able to hide behind these phony accounting numbers. They're going to have to acknowledge some of these losses, and they're going to need that TARP money back. And I'm sure it'll, you know, the government's not going to let them fail. You know, in fact, they might try to claim, oh, it worked so well the first time, we made a profit, we can loan the money out again. And of course, you know, it didn't really work. It simply, you know, postponed the inevitable and probably made the problems a lot worse in the process. You know, also another thing that just happened with government intervention is that some of Chrysler's creditors, a state of Indiana pension fund, you know, they objected to the bankruptcy in Chrysler because they're secured creditors, and they thought they could have got a better deal, but the assets could have been sold to a higher bidder than Fiat, which bid zero. And basically, the Supreme Court threw it out. The Supreme Court says, we don't care about your rights as creditors. We're going to decide based on political considerations. So we no longer have a country of laws. It's a nation of men at this point. Men decide. The laws mean nothing. The Constitution means nothing. Due process means nothing. Politics rule the day. It's whatever Barack Obama wants. That's the law. And here you have creditors who had their rights set aside, and where they would have been able to recover more money, now they get less. At the same time, you had a lot of creditors of AIG, of Bear Stearns, of Citi, of all these companies, where the government bailed them out completely. And if the government had stayed out of it, they would have taken bigger losses than Chrysler creditors. But, you know, the politicians are in here deciding which creditors get bailed out and which creditors get screwed. And this is not how a country should run, and this is not going to create confidence among the rest of the world. We need global capital because we don't have our own. We blew it. Now, I don't want that capital going to government. I don't want the world buying our government bonds because that's, you know, that's – That's financing what we don't need. That's financing bigger government, which is undermining our economy. But we need the world to provide capital to American businesses, to American entrepreneurs, to do things that are economically viable so that we can rebuild our economy. But who's going to want to provide capital to Americans when they know that their rights as creditors or investors can be summarily dismissed by a politicized judicial system? If we don't respect private property, if we don't respect contracts in this country, capitalism can't work. And we're not going to have capitalism without capital, and we don't have our own. Unfortunately, we blew it. But we are doing all of the wrong things as a nation, and we're doing it at a time where we can ill afford it. You know, people think that, you know, the economy is going to recover, that this is like other recessions. It's not. There is no recovery coming. It's not going to happen. It's just going to keep getting worse. The unemployment situation is going to get worse. The economy is going to keep contracting in real terms. And inflation is going to run out of control. Interest rates are going to run out of control. And if all we do, if our only solution is to grow government and to try to find government solutions to government-created problems, and we continue to move down the road to serfdom and follow the ideas of Karl Marx and not the ideas of Adam Smith, you know, we are in some serious, serious trouble. Anyway, I want to quickly hop on the phones. I know there's quite a few people waiting patiently to call. First call is Ethan in Oregon. Ethan, Hello? Are you there? Hi, Ethan.
Yeah,
you're
I'm
on
here.
The air.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you.
I have two questions. My first question is about some of your previous shows. I've been listening to your previous shows back from 2005 and 2006, and you used to talk a lot about how Warren Buffett and Bill Gross at PIMCO were getting out of the dollar, and you used to also talk a lot about the trade deficit, and I was wondering why you don't talk about those things anymore.
Well, I still do. I mean, the trade deficit came out today, and it expanded. It's not as huge as it used to be. We were running trade deficits around $60 billion a month. I think the one we came out with today is just a little over $30 billion. But it's still a huge number, and you know, it's still an evidence of an economy that's malinvested and living beyond its means. And the trade deficit constantly adds to our international indebtedness because we keep going into debt to buy stuff. And so the trade deficit needs to come down. Bill Gross is still advocating getting out of the dollar. He wrote a big piece just in the last week. You know, he's very negative on the dollar. He thinks there's going to be more inflation. So he's still advocating foreign investments. He's telling people to own commodities and foreign bonds. You don't hear that as much from Warren Buffett anymore. I mean, Warren Buffett mm-hmm. was a big foreign investor. It seems that recently with the economic crisis, Warren Buffett has kind of, you know, been indoctrinated as a cheerleader for the U.S. now. And he now talks about the U.S. We've got to invest in the U.S. We've got to buy American. And, you know, I don't think he's saying that as an investor. I think he's saying that as an American. And unfortunately, I think it's the wrong message. I just think, you know, blind optimism is not a sign of patriotism. You know, to support your country right or wrong, if the country is doing the wrong thing, to just pretend it's all going to be okay and just say, hey, this is America, this is the greatest country, and so we have to buy, and ignore reality, ignore what's happening to the country. I mean, maybe we were the greatest country, and maybe we can be the greatest country again, but based on the policies we're pursuing and based on the economy as it stands today, that's not the case. Now, rather than trying to pretend that we're still great, I'd rather acknowledge the problems with the economy and then try to do something about it. And in the meantime, don't encourage people to make foolish investments. I mean, the best thing Americans can do, if they really want to be patriotic, is get their money out of the country now. Get their money into foreign assets. Get their money into precious metals. Because that way, they won't go broke. That way, when it comes time to really rebuild the economy, because we rein in the government and we bring back capitalism, now Americans will have capital to repatriate. And we'll be able to participate in funding the growth of the country again. If we just invest our money in America now, it's just going to be squandered with all the rest.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Also, you talked about how the exchanges that commodities such as oil and gold trade on could potentially go bankrupt if there's hyperinflation. I was wondering if you could expand on that too, please.
Yeah, well, the way that works, if you look at futures markets, you look at the Merck or, you know, the COMEX, what happens is a lot of people are trading oil or trading gold, you know, using futures contracts or derivative instruments, which means that you're buying oil from somebody who really doesn't have oil. you're buying it from somebody who's, you know, who's just gambling in many cases. Now, there are some legitimate hedgers there. There are oil companies that sell forward their production. There are gold companies, and not that many left anymore, that are still hedging. But in many cases, when you buy gold, you know, you're buying from a speculator who's shorting gold. He doesn't actually own any of the gold. And let's assume gold prices really go ballistic, and you decide you want your gold. You decide that you want to take delivery of the contract. Well, they might not be able to get it. In addition, what if gold prices go up dramatically in one day? What if gold goes up $1,000 an ounce in one day? Is it possible? Maybe. And that means that the person who's short gold is way more than he ever imagined he could have possibly lost. Right. I mean, let's say somebody, you know, they thought they had a stop, the market gaps, they don't get whatever happens, it's a fast market, they can't get out. And let's say somebody had, you know, $10,000 in their commodities account and they were short a gold contract, and all of a sudden they lost $100,000 overnight. Well, now the brokerage firm has a debit, a $90,000 unsecured debit. Now they have to try to collect it. Well, what if they can't? And what if not only that customer has a debit, but what if hundreds or thousands of customers have debits and the exchange can't get the money? The exchange goes broke unless they get a government bailout. So there are a lot of risks. I mean, this is what happened with AIG. The reason AIG went bankrupt is because they were the other side of a lot of these speculative contracts. And when a lot of things happened that they had insured against, they couldn't pay. They didn't have the money. And if the government hadn't bailed them out, people would have lost, which means if you buy gold on the COMEX and futures contracts and there's a huge move up and the COMEX goes bankrupt and the government doesn't bail them out, then you're not going to get paid. You're not going to get all the profits that you thought you were going to get. And that happened. The guy talked to somebody who was short a bunch of mortgages, did a lot of interesting things, but they did it through Lehman Brothers, and they didn't hedge. And even though they made millions of dollars on their bets, they lost everything because Lehman went under and didn't pay them. So, you know, these things happen. This is what's called counterparty risk.
Okay, so does that mean that investing in something like the Rogers Commodity Index that buys futures would not be a good idea?
Well, I mean, they don't, you know, those are the risks. Yeah. I mean, if you're owning any entity where there is futures exposure, you have a counterparty risk. I mean, yeah, it exists, you know. Now, they trade on other exchanges too. They're trading on foreign exchanges that might be better capitalized in, you know, countries like Singapore, but they have positions here. But yeah, there's always counterparty risk. You know, that's why, you know, you don't put, you know, all your eggs in one basket. Whether or not these exchanges are actually going to go bankrupt, I don't know. You know, I suppose it's a lower probability event, and you know, judging by what's going on right now, if they do go bankrupt, the government will probably bail them out. I mean, they bail everybody else out. Anyway, thanks for your question. You call.
Okay.
Next up is Mike in California.
Hello, Peter.
Hey, Mike. How are you?
Hey, great. Hey, I got a question for you. Actually, two questions. One is, do you expect the silver to gold ratio to ever go to 10 to 1, and if so, when would that be?
Well, I don't know when that would happen. I expect the silver gold ratio to move in silver's favor over time. You know, I think that right now it's at a level that historically shows silver to be undervalued relative to gold. You know, whether it'll get as high as 10 to 1, you know, it might. I mean, it all depends on the circumstances. Certainly in the peak in 1980, when gold got to 800 and silver was 50, you know, even that wasn't quite 10 to 1, but it was pretty close, you know. You know, we might get to those levels again. We certainly can probably get to 20 to 1. I mean, what are we right now? We're probably still closer to 50 to 1.
Yeah, I think we're around 60 to 1, actually, or 59,
yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
My other question is, my goal is to have 4,000 ounces of physical silver, and then I was going to move on to other investments, and I have called your firm, and I'm kind of salivating on actually starting to invest with you. The other thing that I wanted to add was you couldn't have a bigger cheerleader than myself. I tell everyone that is worth even talking to about finance, money, anything. I always tell them about you, mention your name, and your books. And I just want you to know that you are doing a fantastic job, and there's a lot of people that really appreciate what you're doing.
I appreciate Sure. Well, I appreciate your thoughts, and I certainly appreciate your referring people to my books and to my company. And, yeah, I mean, I think it is very, very important. I mean, I don't look at myself as just a stockbroker, just an investment advisor, because I think, you know, there's a lot more at stake here. I mean, I really believe that people who do not follow my advice are going to be broke. And this is going to be and this is a massive change. Look at what's happened. Look at Mark Faber. Mark Faber now says, and he's a pretty smart guy, he's now saying that he believes it is a 100% certainty that we will have hyperinflation.
Wow.
A la Zimbabwe. 100% certainty. Now, I was at a conference with Mark Faber over a year ago when he was a short-term bull in the dollar. And he's turned around, and now he is a mega, mega bear. And so if he is right, that there is hyperinflation, then people who stay in dollars will be broke. I don't care if you've got $10 million in a CD coming due in 5 years. When it comes due, you know, it could be confetti. Hyperinflation wipes out fortunes. Even if you look at, you know, look at the op-ed today in the Wall Street Journal by Art Laffer. Now, Art Laffer, you know, a lot of guys know him because he's the guy that bet me a penny, you know, in this, on Kudlow. He said, Peter, the economy has never been in better shape. Monetary policy is spectacular. You know, there's going to be a little slowdown, but nothing, right? Art Laffer is now saying that we're going to go through a period of time that is going to make the 1970s look tame. He is talking about massive inflation. He's not saying hyperinflation, but he's saying inflation much higher than the inflation of the 1970s. And wow. If he's right, you know, I mean, you're talking about double-digit inflation where, you know, you're talking about where the first digit is not a one. And you get 20% inflation. That's not hyperinflation. Wow. That's pretty high. But you get 20% inflation 4, 5, 6 years in a row. I mean, that pretty much wipes you out. And so I think it is very, very important. That's why, you know, when the accounts were down last year and people were saying, oh, this is terrible. Look at these accounts are down. I didn't care that they were down because I knew ultimately what was going to happen. I mean, I only cared to the extent that it caused some of my clients to worry and second guess the strategy. And it cost a few people even bailed out on it, you know, because they lost faith. But the people who didn't, the people that wrote it out, and more importantly, the people who took advantage of the gift horse and added to their accounts. And I still think that the valuations today, even though, the prices are not nearly what they were, even though a lot of these stocks have doubled and tripled from where they were in October and even from March, and even though the dollar has lost back most of what it gained, it hasn't lost it all back. And many of the foreign stocks are still 20 or 30% below where they were last year. There's still a lot of bargains out there, and especially compared to where I think things are going to be 6 months from now, a year from now. I mean, if the next 6 months are the same percentage appreciation as the last 6 months, this is already the best year. 2009 has got to be the best year in history for global stocks. It's got to be the best year in history for commodities, even if the year ended right now. I don't think there's ever been a year. Now, of course, it follows the worst year in history for commodities and foreign stocks, which was 2009, but it shows you how quickly things can change and how you don't want to jump to premature conclusions based on short-term market volatility. And people need to understand that this is a serious, serious financial crisis, that it's only beginning. You know, when Ben Bernanke said recently in his testimony, Moni, he said that the Federal Reserve averted catastrophe based on what it did. It didn't overt catastrophe. It's creating the catastrophe. It merely postponed it. And, you know, and of course, you know, he's taking credit for putting out a fire that he lit. It's amazing.
Right. You know, I've told my family, I said, you know, I have a fairly large family. Some of them are high income earners. And I said, you know, none of you know anything about money. You know absolutely nothing about finance. One of us has to learn what's going on. And that's what I study night and day.
Good.
Going on. And I repeat your name quite often just because, you know, I have so much, I have huge respect for you. And you're somebody that doesn't deviate either. I notice when you're under fire, you don't deviate at all. You say the truth no matter how hard it is to take. And that's what we need.
Well, it's not hard, because when the truth is on your side, you don't have to deviate. It's when, you know, it's when you don't have the facts, or when you're making things up, that you have to change your story, that you fluster. You know, one of the interesting things about, you know, the Jon Stewart show is, you know, Jon Stewart, you know, usually when you look at people on the comedy show, he loves to, look for hypocrisy. He loves to show people that are inconsistent, or people, who have contradicted themselves, and play that up. But, you know, with me, you know, I mean, I'm on the show, and he's, you know, he's generally respects me, even though politically, you know, he's probably, you know, left the center. He's pretty liberal. And here I am, you know, talking bad about Bill Clinton. I mean, not Bill Clinton, about Barack Obama, and talking about potentially running for the Senate as a Republican. And he's, you know, he's happy about it. He's shaking my hand. He's saying, great to have you on. He's, you know, he's not jumping all over me like he would have somebody else. And, you know, he's not beating me up like he did with Jim Cramer when he came up.
That was something. Hey, one more question. Right. Do you think they're ever going to take back gold, make it illegal again?
I hope not. But one of the reasons that we're putting so much gold in Australia in the Perth Mint is better safe than sorry. You know, based on what our government is doing, I wouldn't put it past them. And we are getting more and more corrupt by the day. You know, the longer the government tries to keep this phony economy going, the more corrupt we become. The more of our rights we surrender, the less free we get. Anyway, thanks for the call, Mike, and appreciate the help.
Thank you. Let me
go to Travis in Colorado.
Hey, Peter. Great job on the Daily Show yesterday.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, I was wondering what happens if treasuries keep selling off and interest rates are raised. Would that hurt gold prices? Or?
Well, you know, in the short run, it could. I don't think in the long run, because I don't think the Fed is going to be aggressive enough with its rate hikes to really rein in any of the inflation. I mean, and that's the box the Fed is in. You know, remember, in the 1980, when Volcker was raising rates, he had to bring rates all the way up to 20% in order to really stop gold's prices, you know, increase and put an end to inflation. How could we do that today? I mean, the economy couldn't withstand even 10% interest rates. Homeowners couldn't. Everybody would default. All the adjustable rate mortgages would default. The government couldn't pay the national debt. I mean, we've got the biggest adjustable rate interest mortgage of them all. If interest rates went to 10% and we had to pay $1.5 trillion a year in interest on the debt of our creditors, we couldn't do it. So the interest rates high enough to prop up the dollar would crush the economy, which would also force the dollar down. So I don't think there's anything the Fed can do that's going to stop gold from rising, that's going to stop the dollar from falling. Even if we do all the right things, the dollar has to fall and gold has to rise based on all the wrong things we've already done. Now, what I would like to see happen is, after the dollar falls and gold, you know, rises, that we do something to stabilize the dollar so it doesn't keep falling forever. I mean, unfortunately, we're going to have to deal with a lower dollar as the consequence of all the bad activity. Like, you know, if you haven't dieted and you haven't exercised, and now you have to live with the results because you're obese and out of shape. But that doesn't mean you have to stay that way. That doesn't mean you can't change your habits and get back into shape. But right now, before we can get back into shape, we have to deal with the fact that we're out of shape based on all these years of bad behavior.
Do you think as gold rises and as people start to realize that inflation is happening, is there any chance that they would flee gold for a stock market? Maybe they would get better gains in the stock market? Or
no, I mean, look, gold is going to do better than stocks in inflation, with the exception of maybe gold stocks or mining stocks or, you know, other stocks where, you know, they have leverage to rising prices. But in general, just typical stocks during inflation, I mean, inflation is not good for stocks, because inflation is not good for business. It's not good economics. The way that stocks benefit through inflation is purely a nominal gain. It's simply that money loses more value than stocks. Now, in some respects, if you're a corporation and you have some debt on your books and there's a lot of inflation, you basically wipe out the debt. And so what happens is some of the value of that company gets transferred from the debtor to the equity holder. And so by owning stocks in an inflationary period of time, you end up on the receiving end of that, because inflation transfers wealth from debtors to creditors or from debtors to the common shareholders. So in that respect, but it's not, you know, earnings are not going to thrive. Corporations are not really going to do well in a period of high inflation. But certainly stocks will do better than bonds and cash. But, you know, in real terms, you know, it's they're not going to do as badly as bonds and cash. You'll lose less wealth in stocks. But
I totally agree, but I know like lots of people have a problem buying gold just because of the crash in prices in the 80s. Like, my dad won't buy gold because of that. He's afraid of it because of that.
Yeah, and look, and I also, again, I like buying real assets. As I said, inflationary times, you know, it's good to own stuff. It's, you know, and that's what everybody was throwing out. Remember, in late 2008, everybody assumed that it was global deflation, that all businesses were going to collapse, that all assets were practically worthless, and the world just threw everything out. They wanted to sell whatever they owned because they couldn't get enough treasuries. They couldn't get enough dollars. Well, look at that lousy trade. Somebody that loaded up on treasuries at the end of 2008, they bought 10-year treasuries yielding 2%. Now they're at 4%. You know how much of a loss that is? If you bought a 30-year bond in December and you now have you're stuck clipping a 2% coupon for the next 30 years, what do you think you could get if you tried to unload that bond right now? That is a huge, huge loss. People did all the wrong things at the end of 2008 because they jumped to all the wrong conclusions based on a few months of market movements. And the people who, you know, who bet deflation are rapidly trying to change their bets and get the chips off deflation and put them on inflation. And you know, of course, all the inflation trades are getting a lot more expensive and the deflation trades are getting crushed. Anyway,
all right,
thanks a lot. All right, let me quick hop out of order because I've got somebody calling from Oxford, England. So let me take Paul's call. How are you doing, Paul?
Hiya. Cool. This is great. I got two short questions. The first thing is I hold a lot of metals in an ETF held in Switzerland, but with the fears of confiscation, how safe do you think they are?
Well, I think it's safer in Switzerland than if you had it in the United States. I don't think the Swiss government's going to confiscate gold. So I think that'd be all right. But I also recommend that people have gold in more than one location and that they certainly have gold in their physical possession, not in the safety deposit box, but, you know, in your basement, buried in your backyard or, you know, hidden behind
something. Yeah, I have a little bit of gold in physical.
Yeah.
But I like the other metals as well, platinum and palladium and silver a little bit. And we get taxed too heavily in England to buy platinum or palladium physically.
So I have to hold it
in an ETF.
Yeah, you can also do it through the Perth Mint in Australia. We work that. We sell that. You can have platinum there. They stopped doing palladium, but you can do platinum as well as gold and silver.
All right, okay. I might buy some there. I have a second question, though, sorry. With the state of the American government, and I think all the Western governments and what they're doing now, I wondered if you could suggest, is there somewhere in the world that is actually run well, that has limited government? Is there anywhere that it's worth moving to?
Well, nobody is perfect. I don't think any of the nations around the world are as ideally capitalistic as the U.S. was, let's say, at the turn of the last century, you know, 1900, around then, you know, the period after the Civil War and before the First World War. I think that was as close as anybody has come. But certainly, if you look around the world, if you look at the Asian economies, the taxes are a lot lower, the regulations are fewer, there's more economic freedom, although in some of the countries like China, there's less political freedom. But there's certainly more economic freedom. Markets are more dynamic. I think there's even more respect for private property. And obviously, there's no respect left in the U.S. So, you know, there are other places in the world that are in much better shape than the U.S. and the U.K. for that matter.
So Asia, you think mainly there?
Yeah, it's a personal decision. It's a cultural decision. You know, I think, look, English-speaking countries, I think Australia, New Zealand, I think Canada are in much better position than the United States. That can change. I mean, look, if we put the right policies into place, if we can reverse course, you know, America could be the best emerging market in the world at some point. I mean, we can, you know, but we have to make changes right now based on...
It all looks far too bleak at the moment. I don't think anyone's... It really doesn't seem as though... It almost feels as though it's too late even if America was willing to do anything.
Yeah, well, America, see, America, we don't want to admit our mistakes, so we're just going to keep making them and making them bigger and bigger and bigger and keep compounding the mistake. Instead of acknowledging what we did wrong and trying to correct it by reversing course, we can't admit that. We just want to think that, no, we just need more spending. We need more credit. Just print more money, run bigger deficits, as if we're not in as much enough trouble based on all the money we already printed and all the deficits we ran up. But
yeah.
It doesn't even occur to anybody in this government that they're the problem, that they're the reason we're in so much trouble. And if they just do more of what they've been doing, they're going to worsen the situation. And at some point, it's going to make it intolerable here. At some point, it's not just going to be you asking, where should I go? But young Americans everywhere are going to be looking at where they can emigrate. I mean, how can they get out of this country? How are they going to have an opportunity to prosper? And they're going to have to leave. Remember, our country was built on immigrants who left other countries because they saw more opportunity here. And if things change and Americans have no opportunity because the government has robbed it all and they see more opportunity in other countries, they're going to go.
Mm. And at least with America's reserve currency status, though, at least for the short term, it seems a better bet than England or Europe, do you think? Or?
No, as I said, I think the reserve currency status has been a two-edged sword. I mean, it's enabled us to live beyond our means, but that's why we're in so much trouble. And I think we're in worse shape than England because we've been issuing the reserve currency. And the world has cut us a lot more slack. They've given us a lot of extra rope that we've used to hang ourselves.
All right. So you think I'm better off here in England than America?
I think so. I mean, I don't think, you know, England isn't, you know, my top choice. I think the problems in England are not as bad, even though they're bad. I don't think they're as bad as the problems in the U.S. And I still think that, you know, that we could see England join the Eurozone, and I think the pound might end up being folded into the euro, which I think would be, you know, a positive for that whole region. I think that ultimately will happen. And I've been saying that for a while because I thought that that was the way of – that's the way the U.K. could get out of jail would be to join the euro.
All right. I didn't see that as a good thing. I didn't realize.
Well, I think
so – sorry, go on.
Yeah, in the long run, I don't know. Look, in the long run, I'm not a big fan of the euro either, especially if the euro becomes the reserve currency. Because if the euro becomes the reserve currency, then Europe's going to make all the mistakes we did. And eventually, Europe's going to suffer. It's like, you know, it's like it's a blessing and a curse having the reserve currency.
Good short-term, bad long-term, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping. Yeah, I mean, definitely
down there.
You think
Australia and Canada, though, sorry, is better. Do you have any idea about Vietnam? Do you know anything about there? Is it a good place to move to?
No, I've never been there, and so I don't know. But anyway, I really appreciate the call. I want to hop because I got a few more people on hold.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your time. I'm a massive fan. Everything you say, it just rings true, and there's actual logic behind your arguments. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Paul. Okay, next caller is Jed in California. And let's take no more callers. I've got four people on hold. I'll try to get to everybody before the end of the hour. Okay, go ahead, Jed.
Hey, Peter. Just a quick question for you. Since I've been listening to you, I've been buying commodities, but I also have some cash put away because I do want to buy, a condo or something at some point in the future. My question is, should I really get rid of all that cash and put it into commodities and mining stocks, or should I have some in cash, just basically for a rainy day kind of thing?
Well,
what's your advice on that?
Well, I think it makes sense to have some cash for living expenses and emergency money. I would not be holding on to cash in anticipation of buying a condo in the future. I think it's going to be a long time before condo prices really bottom, and I think if you really want to buy a condo, keep your money in gold, you'll be able to buy a much better condo, a much nicer condo, than what you can afford if you keep your money in dollars. In the meantime, if you're renting, if you buy a lot of these foreign stocks, the dividend yields are still very high. You can collect a lot of dividends that you can use to pay rents. I recommend that people have less cash than I used to. You know, when I wrote Crash Proof, the original version, and I recommended having cash in case there were some bargains when the initial collapse happened, I thought the foreign stocks would fall in sympathy with ours, and so I recommended having some cash on the sidelines to take advantage of that. In Crash Proof 2, which is coming out, I am not advocating as much liquidity because I think that opportunity to go bargain hunting is over. I think the initial knee-jerk reaction that I thought might happen, where foreign stocks would go down in sympathy with our stocks, even though the decline was bigger than I thought, because it was magnified by the strength of the dollar, which I didn't expect, which was temporary. I don't think there's as much of a reason to hold liquidity anymore, because I think now there's so much inflation that's been created that I think it's more likely that asset prices will keep rising from here. So I think that you really want to be invested. I mean, you know, much more so than before.
Okay, I've been kind of teetering, but I think that pushed me over the edge, and I'm just going to have enough for a rainy day and then put the rest away, and then a few years down the line, buy a place. I appreciate your advice, Peter.
Okay.
Thank you.
And don't put an arbitrary time horizon. 2 years might be too soon, you know. There's nothing wrong with renting. Next up is Eric in New York.
Hello, Peter. I'm a big fan, and kudos to you for everything you've done for us.
Thank you.
And I want to ask you, as irrational as it may have been, the dollar in the last few days has shown some strength. And I'm talking just in the last, 3, 4, 5, 6 days. To what do you attribute that? Is that just, a short-term bounce because it's fallen so hard, so fast? Or is there actually some rumblings here of a counter trend rally, like some strength in the dollar coming?
Now, as I mentioned on my video blog, markets don't move in a straight line. The dollar is not going to drop every single day. Right? There are going to be bounces. People who are shorting the dollar are going to want to cover their shorts, and they're going to have to buy and push the dollar up. Other people are going to want to bet the dollar is going to rise. There's always short-term trading. But the trend for the dollar right now is clearly down. The chart looks horrible for the dollar index. The reverse of that, if you look at the currencies, the euro or the Aussie dollar or the Canadian dollar, the charts look very bullish. And so I think these trends are going to stay in motion, because you've got two things now. You've got the fundamentals are lousy for the dollar, and you've got the technicals that are lousy for the dollar.
Okay.
And so everything is lining up. And when you see these small moves, I mean, even though the dollar index has risen, it's barely above 80. I mean, it's just 80-20. I mean, it's falling. And the thing that really, I think, was amazing is the inability of the bonds to have any kind of meaningful rally. I mean, the bond sell-off is relentless. And if you look at that chart, it is so powerful a chart. And there are many charts to me. If you look at a chart of crude oil, I mean, that is such a bullish-looking chart. I mean, I don't see any real resistance in oil till 100, and even that I don't think is going to be formable. So these technical patterns really, to me, look explosive. Like we're heading for a huge breakdown in bonds, which means a surge in interest rates, an explosion in commodity prices, a collapse in the dollar. The chart patterns are screaming that, and the fundamentals are screaming that. So I think you got to stick with them.
Okay. If nominally here in the U.S. we do get a fall assuming that this is a bear market rally, if we do get a fall here, do you think there might be a second international shock in which the rest, in your best estimation, in which the rest of the world also takes, the stock markets also take a hit, even if it's not nearly as deep as it was in, last fall?
Yeah, I mean, I'm never going to say that, nothing is possible. Anything is possible, certainly given what happened last year. So we have to be prepared for the fact that maybe we will get another global sell-off in stock prices and maybe even a rally in the dollar. But I think that is a lower probability event. I think it is more likely that that was last year's trade, that too many people already bought into that head fake, and the market is not going to, recreate that buying opportunity. We're not going to see a huge drop in foreign stocks and rise in the dollar and let the people that bet the other way get out of jail. I just don't think that that's going to happen. I think it already happened, and looking at the charts, that's how the charts look to me too. Just looking at it technically, and I think, as I said, the fundamentals are there. So I don't even think it's worth trying to bet on that outcome, because I think the probability of an outcome where the dollar just collapses and foreign stocks keep rising, if you bet wrong, you know, and you try to finesse it. You think, okay, let me go back to dollars and wait to buy an opportunity, and then there's hyperinflation, and you got nothing. You know, I think it's, you know, I've said it's like, you know, if you're in a lifeboat, you don't get back on the Titanic for one last dance. You know, you
right.
stay in that lifeboat, even if it's a little bumpy, even if some water is spraying up in your face. It's better than getting back on a doomed ship and risking making it back to the lifeboat.
I agree. I've read Crash Proof, and I've heard you make that analogy a couple times before, and I agree with you. The whatever I've read in the last couple of days from the media says, the U.S. stock market has fallen because the bond market the bond bubble's been popping, bonds are collapsing, and therefore interest rates are rising, and therefore that's the reason U.S. stock markets are falling. But at the same time, that's been causing some strength in the dollar.
It hasn't caused strength in the dollar. The dollar is near the lows of the move right now. So we've had a couple of days where the dollar has strengthened. But again, that's going to happen in a downtrend. Nothing goes down every day. Anyway, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
And also, just quickly, you know, on the foreign stocks, we're still getting every day, you know, in the overnight markets, when I look around my screen, there are several stocks that move up 5 to 10% in a given day. And, you know, sure, once in a while you see a stock down 5 or 10%, but there's a lot more stocks going up by big numbers right now than going down. And overall, the trend is up, and you've got the dollar falling. So the wind is at your back. I don't think that these dynamics are going to change. To me, these trends look very, very powerful, very secular, and I think they're more likely to accelerate than reverse. Anyway, let me go to Robert in Oklahoma.
Hi, Peter. I'm Robert. I'm a big fan of yours. I have an account with your firm. It's done quite well, so I'm pleased. My question, similar to the other caller, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay. I also follow not only you, but Robert McHugh, who talks about a grand supercycle bear market depression, in which he says that a possible cataclysmic wave seek down could occur that would result in up to a 90% collapse in the stock market. Do you foresee this as a possibility in the future?
Well, I do not think that there will be a 90% decline in the stock market in nominal terms. I just think so much inflation will be created that I do not believe that we're going to see the Dow Jones trading at, you know, under 1,000, right? That's what 90% decline from here. But I do believe that it's possible that we could see a real decline, because remember, I'm calling for the Dow to be worth 1 ounce of gold. And based on where gold is right now at $930 an ounce, $940, that would represent a decline in the Dow of 90% if the Dow were to fall down to 930 from 8,700. But I don't expect that to happen. The way I expect the Dow and gold to meet is for gold to come up. And so maybe it'll happen with Dow 5,000, gold 5,000. But it could happen with Dow 50,000, gold 50,000. Now, just because the Dow went to 50,000, you know, people shouldn't celebrate. They're not actually richer, because if in the process gold went from 900 to 50,000, all that it means is the dollar lost a lot of value. And so I think that in real terms it's possible that stocks could lose 90%. I don't think it's going to happen in nominal terms.
Okay, and one last comment to make. Maybe it's time to coin a new word when Bernanke and others testify before Congress. Instead of testimony, is it testifony?
Yeah, well, the interesting thing, too, now is, you know, Bernanke, there's some kind of subpoena. Because, you know, I've said this, I think Bernanke should be in jail along with Henry Paulson. But I guess, you know, these guys strong-armed Bank of America at Ken Lewis into buying Merrill Lynch, even though he didn't want to, because he knew about horrific losses, and he didn't disclose those losses to Bank of America shareholders. They could have backed out of that deal based on a material change of circumstances, but they didn't, because they caved in to the arm twisting of the government. And again, this is going back to, we have a nation of men now, not a nation of laws. There is no respect for the law. There's no respect for the Constitution. There's no respect for private property. What kind of country are we becoming? We're becoming a country that in no way resembles the ideals of the country, the ideals that we were founded on, and what most people think that we have. And we got to put an end to this, and we got to do it soon. Anyway,
I agree,
thanks
and
for the call.
I'm really confounded at how come the Supreme Court didn't really examine the rights of the secured creditors, you know.
Because they don't have any guts to stand up to the Congress and to the president. Anyway, last caller is Sam in Michigan. Go ahead, Sam.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for taking my call. Actually, just two quick questions for you. Number one, you talk about the Perth Mint in Australia and holding gold there. I want to know what you think about holding gold in, let's say, Canadian banks. I don't know if they have ever expropriated gold like the U.S. has, but what are, like, pros and cons of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think Canada, you know, again, they have a very good mining industry in Canada. I just don't know of like the Perth Mint program. But, yeah, I mean, if you're going to store gold with Canadian banks, I don't think Canadian government is going to confiscate gold. You know, the reason I think our government might do it is because we're in a lot more trouble. And governments don't do that. Governments don't take those type of aggressive, oppressive acts unless their backs are to the wall. I mean, and it's hard to even get the public to swallow it unless there's a real, real crisis, unless there's a lot of fear. And the government plays on that fear and pretends that only by this type of action can the government protect us. I mean, the government at that point will try to label gold speculators, gold hoarders, as part of the problem. They'll try to say the reason the dollar is so weak, the reason that food is so expensive, is because these evil, greedy speculators are hoarding gold, and we need to punish them, or we need to take that gold away, or something like that. So, and I don't think you're going to have those circumstances in Canada.
Okay, yeah, I totally agree with you. And also, too, you know, Jim Rogers is always on TV talking about even owning farmland itself, but a lot of times you need to be, you know, an accredited investor. Do you know of any programs where you can buy into partnerships or anything like that, even with smaller amounts?
What we're doing mainly at Europe Pacific Capital is there are a number of agricultural investments that we've made in various types of farmland, dairy farms, companies, or company, you know, just more traditional crops, and so we're making those types of investments, and we're investing in businesses that service the agricultural sector. And so that's how we're doing it. I mean, I'm not necessarily, you know, helping people get into private illiquid partnerships of farms that are operated offshore. I mean, I think there's more risk there, and certainly you don't have the liquidity. But there are plenty of ways to invest in those segments through publicly traded stocks that are trading on major exchanges, and you know, you don't have to deal with, you know, partnerships and things like that.
Right. Okay. And yeah. And one more thing too. I cannot wait till you come out with that mutual fund you were talking about, especially for smaller investors who don't have, you know, necessarily a large chunk of money.
Yeah. I mean, we can't really. I mean, I really can't talk about it until it's actually out, you know, because of, you know, those types of rules. But yeah, I mean, we're going to do something with China, and I think China is an area that I am extremely bullish on. And for some people, and for people that don't have a tremendous amount of money and they really want to get a lot of exposure to China, it's difficult to build a China portfolio that's well diversified unless you have a lot of money. And so for people that, you know, have less money, if I can put together some type of fund where I can, you know, diversify into those opportunities, because, you know, there's going to be companies that fail. But there's going to be companies that go up 100 times, you know. So the key is, you know, to try to pick the winners and make sure that if you have a few of the losers, that, you know, they're smaller in number than the big winners, you know. But anyway, thanks for the call. Well, I'm down to the last few minutes here. Yeah, the hour tends to go by rather quickly. Anyway, look, I think the week ahead, again, is going to be a very, very interesting week, you know, both what's going on, in the government and what might be going on with these hearings with the Fed, and what's happening in the currency markets and the bond market. As I said, I expect these trends not only to not reverse but to accelerate. And, you know, the ramifications here are clear. And the vote of no confidence in the Obama administration and in the Federal Reserve is clear. And when, you know, when we send our representatives around the world and they're greeted with laughter, and we're out there telling them that we're going to balance the budget, we're going to act responsibly, and the world understands that this is all nonsense. We're just saying what we need to say, and they're not buying it, you know. Just like little kids lying to their parents, you know, their parents, you know, understand what the motivation is, and that the kids are going to say whatever they need to say to get what they want. And if the world's not going to cooperate, this is real, real decision time. at for the U.S. Anyway, that's it for today. Don't forget, call up 800-727-7922, 800-727-7922 to talk to a Euro Pacific Capital broker to get your account going. That's it for today. So long, everybody.